On Tech News Today, we talk the 9 to 5 Mac's Mark Gurman, Recode's Peter Kafka, The Wall Street Journal's Lisa Fleischer, Fast Company's Harry McCracken, Search Engine Land's Danny Sullivan, and The Hill's Corey Bennett. You don't want to miss this episode of Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, May 22nd, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Today is National Ethernet Day. Okay, I made it up. It's not really, there's no such thing as National Ethernet Day, but it was on this day in 1973 that Xerox PARC researcher Robert Metcalfe wrote a memo proposing a little something he called Ethernet. Of course, it wasn't until 1980 that this began to be implemented. Anyway, it's a day that will live in infamy, and thank you, Robert Metcalfe, for Ethernet. My name is Mike Elgin. I'm the host today. Christina Warren, our normal Friday co-anchor, is off today. And we got a ton of news and some amazing guests. So let's jump right into the top story. With Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference just a couple of weeks away, leaks about what Apple will announce are coming out almost every day or maybe even every day. And most of them from 9 to 5 Mac's Mark Gurman. Mark joins us now to talk about new information he's reported about Apple's plans. Welcome to you, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being on. Now, the iPad was a rare weak spot in Apple's recent earnings report, but the company apparently is investing in big improvements. Can you tell us what your sources are telling you about the products codenamed J98 and J99?
Right. So there's three things. The first thing that they're doing is announcing a new split-screen view for the iPad Pro, which is expected to come out later in the year. And that also may come to the iPad Air and iPad Mini in June at the Worldwide Developers Conference. That allows you to have two different windows open at once or two windows of the same app. So if you want to have two web browser tabs side by side. Next thing they're doing is a multi-user mode, kind of like you have on Macs and PCs. If you want to share an iPad between multiple students, multiple family members, etc., you could have your own individual logins, only accessing your media content and such. And like the big hardware thing there, like you said, is J98, J99. That's a larger 12-inch iPad. Looks mostly like a jumbo iPad Air, some additional speakers and microphones around the edges. But other than that, it has a new user interface that's more optimized for the bigger screen that really plays nicely with the split-screen views.
Now, is the split-screen view and the multi-user login, are those things for the future versions of the iPad, or will these be applied to older iPads?
The split screen view currently planned for older iPads, and we'll see in June whether or not that's still the case. The multi-user support is planned for both as well. Multi-user support was supposed to be announced in June, but a few months ago they decided to punt it, so like remove it from iOS 9. They're still working on it because Apple executives believe it's critical to the enterprise and education markets, so it will come eventually, but not in the very near future.
Now, you've been reporting a lot about iOS 9, which I believe is codenamed Monarch. Can you talk about some of the highlights from what you've learned?
So the bigger picture here is that there's a lot of enhancements on optimization, performance, security, all wrapped together for this release. Big emphasis on supporting older iPhones, the iPhone 4S, the first iPad mini, the iPad 2. It's the first time in many years they're kind of taking a step back and focusing more on optimization rather than just adding new features. We posted a story about that, as you can see on the screen this morning. Other new features, though, is a transit mapping mode for Apple Maps, which means that you can get directions on buses, subways, trains, to airports, etc. There's a new HomeKit app in the works, which will allow you to control appliances that are HomeKit enabled directly through a single app. There's some new iCloud Drive functionality in the works, which with better encryption. New trusted Wi-Fi features and rootless security, which means a more stable operating system and the reduction of malware possibilities and safer inter-app communication. A big thing for some people is a new code base for the operating system that's going to make app download sizes are smaller, about 8 megabytes smaller a piece, which should be easier on your data plans as well as on your storage. So let's say you have a smaller iPhone with like 16 gigs of storage, you'll have a little bit of ease up storage in your settings app. So that will be nice for a lot of people.
Now, you mentioned the Apple TV working as a hub for home automation. That makes a lot of sense for Apple TV owners, but most iPhone owners don't own Apple TVs. What is going to be the difference, or do you have any information about what the difference will be for home automation between people who just have an iPhone and people who have both an iPhone and an Apple TV?
Well, the Apple TV will serve as a hub to link devices together. So let's say you just have a light set up for HomeKit, you'll be able to connect that to the phone. Or let's say you have multiple appliances, they'll all connect to a phone. But those different appliances will have an easier time talking to each other with the Apple TV as a hub. And I believe part of the reason why they lowered the price $69 back in March is to help upsell the Apple TV when they do promote this new HomeKit stuff. And Peter will tell you more about the Apple TV next. So
yeah, I'm sure he will. Well, that's right. We got a packed show today and there's a lot more to talk about. Unfortunately, we don't have the time, but I want everybody right now to go to 9to5Mac and read the recent stories by Mark Gurman. He's talking about new security stuff, lots of stuff about Swift. So if you're interested in the Swift programming language, you want to read what he's written there. Mark, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. Sorry it was such a short segment. But again, I thank you and keep up those scoops, man.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
All right. You can find Mark at 9to5Mac.com and on Twitter at Mark Gurman. Got some more news for you in just a second, but first I want to talk about Braintree, our sponsor today. Braintree is for you mobile app developers out there. I know there's a lot of them listening to this show, and you got to check out Braintree because Braintree is the simple payment solution behind the simple and appealing apps from Uber, from Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Munchery. These were recently tiny startups that through help from Braintree grew into huge successful companies that people love, and this simplified payment system is a big part of the magic of these companies. Now, with Braintree, you can accept PayPal, Apple Pay, all kinds of credit cards like Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, even Diners Club. You can even accept Bitcoin via Braintree. You can accept up to 130 currencies, and Braintree works with some of the leading e-commerce and billing platforms, including Shopify, Magento, and Wufoo. And if you do this sort of thing, you know what Wufoo is. Libraries for 6 server-side languages and mobile SDKs for iOS and Android. They've got it all. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution and support for all payment types for your customers, including PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and more, all with a single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, superior customer service, and fast payouts. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/TNT. Apple intends to offer local TV stations to its upcoming TV service, according to an exclusive on Recode by Peter Kafka and Don Shmilovsky. Unfortunately, the live TV component may delay Apple's TV service rollout, according to the report. Peter Kafka joins us now. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on.
Too.
Yeah. Now, why is local TV so important to Apple, so important that they may be willing to even delay the service?
It's counterintuitive. I mean, I can't imagine the folks who are likely to either cut the cord or aren't getting cable TV and might sign up for an Apple TV service to be interested in local TV. Apple thinks differently. So they're spending a bunch of time and effort trying to figure out both on a business side and also technically how they can get dozens and hundreds of local TV streams sent to the Apple TV so that people, if you're in Tulsa or Minneapolis, wherever, and you want to watch your local ABC affiliate for whatever reason, you could do that.
I suspect that, for everyday news, I agree with you. It doesn't sound very compelling, but, you know, when it comes time for the Super Bowl or whatever, maybe that's event programming is one of the things.
Yeah, again, most sports are national feeds. I mean, one thing that one of the networks told me was, you know, this is relevant for sports like the NFL that have blackout provisions or may have blackout provisions. That won't be the case this year, but it's possible that something would only be available in a local market, wouldn't be available nationally, so that'd be relevant there.
Now, reading your article, I kind of became overwhelmed by how difficult it sounds to line up these programming deals. Can you explain a little bit why it's so difficult to get local programming on their service?
So there's two layers of difficulty. One is that the networks don't often own the actual TV station that their stuff is going out on. It's owned by someone independently. So they've got that whoever owns the station has to agree to the service. They've also got their own layer of programming that's specific to that network to that station that has to get cleared. There's their own local commercials. All sorts of stuff that, again, I think most people wouldn't care about seeing, but if you want to offer a complete service, and apparently Apple does, you have to nail all this stuff down. It takes a ton of time. I mentioned this in the piece. You can see how much work it took ABC to get the ability to live stream just 8 of their markets through what's called the Watch ABC app. It's quite a labor-intensive process. Again, both sort of figuring out the biz dev issues. And then apparently, I mean, this is not splitting the atom, but it will take time and effort to build a system that actually brings these streams to Apple.
Now, of course, with local TV delivered over the internet, would I be stuck with my own locale? I mean, couldn't I get local television from New York City or something like that, even out here in California?
I don't know. I have a hunch that what Apple is going to want to do is tell the networks, look, this is going to work just like conventional pay TV. So if you're in New York, you watch the New York version of ABC. It's important for the networks to retain that kind of geofencing, at least in their minds, for several years to come. So in Apple's position, this is not something that's going to blow up TV, but sort of replicate what you're already getting from cable TV. It'll be more elegant, it'll be better, it'll be Apple-like, but it won't be fundamentally different than what you'd get if you have Time Warner Cable in Brooklyn, for instance.
Interesting. Now, do you have any predictions about what Apple is going to announce at its WWDC event, which is, what, in 2.5 weeks? Around Apple TV specifically.
I don't, in terms of the service, I don't think they're going to be able to announce anything. I mean, in theory, they can come out and say, this is what I want to build. But since they don't have any networks signed on, and Apple doesn't usually do that sort of gamesmanship where they sort of pre-announce a product where they haven't locked it up. Occasionally, they've sort of skirted around the edges. But I think they would want to have at least several networks lined up before they said, we've signed them up and we're going to launch this at whatever date. They're nowhere near being able to do that today. It's possible all this stuff changes radically in a couple of weeks, but I doubt it.
It's agonizing for those of us who live and die by this kind of news, because Apple tends to be on the brink of doing something sometimes for years. Apple Watch is a perfect example.
This is by far the closest they've come.
Yeah.
The approach they're taking this round is palatable to all the TV programmers. They're not, again, asking them to reinvent the wheel. The programmers are conceptually okay with it. Some of them are starting to sort of get in sort of final stages of discussions. But these are long, complicated agreements to pull off. And then Apple has to do them with several networks to make this a product. So I do think it's going to happen. It just may not happen this fall. It may even get pushed back maybe 2016. It's much more important for Apple to come up with a version of this that really works right off the bat than to have a half-assed version.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter Kafka cranks out exclusives at Recode.net, and you can follow him on Twitter at pkafka. Thanks for joining us today, Peter.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. The matchmaking and a hookup site Adult Friend Finder got hacked, according to a report by the UK's Channel 4 News. Lisa Fleischer is a tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal and joins us by phone from the English countryside, which in no way looks like Southern California. Welcome to you, Lisa.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Now, this is pretty bad, right? What kind of personal information may have been compromised here?
Well, so first of all, on the pretty bad part, the problem with this kind of hack is you start to find out who wants to cheat on their spouse, who's looking for what, who has certain sexual preferences, and that kind of stuff could be potentially used for blackmail or could be used for some sort of ransom or whatnot. I mean, and now it's for the what was taken. Preliminarily, it looks like there were some usernames, you know, kind of an address type thing, like so your state, maybe a zip code, IP addresses, and no passwords or financial information yet, it doesn't seem. At least the company says it has no evidence that any financial information or passwords are stolen. But I mean, as we've seen in other hacks, like just because your credit card details weren't taken or your password wasn't taken, doesn't mean there's like not enough there to do damage. I mean, think about phishing attacks. Like if you know enough, a username, maybe a zip code or various little pieces of information, you can probably put together fairly easily a phishing email.
And even if you don't, this would be prime data. Just the news of this hack is enough to blackmail users if you can find, if you can connect with them and contact them via email or whatever. And it seems like this kind of data might fetch a lot of money on the open market for, you know, among blackmailers or something.
Yeah, totally. So the UK's Channel 4 News kind of blew this story open a bit, meaning, you know, gave a lot of publicity to it. But actually, there was a security researcher about a month ago that sort of found out about this, or 2 months ago found out about it, blogged about it in April. And where it was posted, if you go onto the dark web, if you go into, you know, if you use your Tor browser and go kind of searching around for this, you can find out that the person who posted this allegedly, or from what it looks like, claims that he was owed money by the company, and so therefore was doing it almost like as a revenge. So, I mean, obviously it's unclear whether any of that is true, but in terms of what the motivation was behind it, that's the only indication that we have. It didn't appear that he was selling it. I mean, or he or she, it could be she. The person posted the files online. I mean, if you, you know, if you have access to that kind of thing, you can download it yourself. And the digital security firm, Digital Shadows, it's a London-based firm, told me earlier that in the very early parts of the day, maybe yesterday for the West Coast, they had only seen like one or two versions of these databases online. But as the story kind of spread, mirrors or copies or whatever started be posting elsewhere. So I guess we'll see if there's any ramifications from this.
What is the company that behind Adult Friend Finder doing about all this? What has their response been?
So they, okay, I haven't looked at the site in a couple of hours, but when I looked at it a few hours ago, there was no notification, it seemed, on the site that this had happened. I mean, clearly they knew about it. They had already responded to the BBC and to Channel 4 and to others. USA Today, they'd even responded to. I mean, if you go on the Home Depot site right now, there's like at the very top, it says notification about data breach or something like that. And it's like every time I go, I think, wait, was there another one? But no, actually, it's just from like the previous one, whenever it was, November or something. So, you know, I don't know if that there's a notification on the site at the moment. But what they said they're doing is they've hired a security firm. They've contacted law enforcement. They contacted the FBI. And they also are, for their own members, disabling a username search function. So if you have a file that has usernames, you can't look people up by their username. And they've also, for some of the people who are apparently affected, or at least, you know, they see their usernames, they've somehow like obfuscated or hidden their usernames from view in some ways.
Wow. Yet another hack. They just keep getting more devastating. This is really...
I know, and this one, I just, you know, if you have any indication, if you've ever been to Adult Friend Finder or know anyone, it's kind of one of those, like, social sort of dating sites, and I put dating kind of in quotes because It's, like, pretty obvious what it's there for. It's to go out and meet people for sex. So when you hear, like, this thing was hacked, like, that's, it's not necessarily that a company was hacked. It's just that this site, which is kind of like, you know, has a bit of a reputation, maybe raises some eyebrows.
Yeah, users are going to get screwed one way or the other, it sounds like. Lisa Fleischer is at WSJ.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Lisa Fleischer. Thank you so much for joining us, Lisa Fleischer.
Thanks very much. Have a good weekend.
All right, bye-bye. Adobe is killing its Photoshop Touch and making big changes in its mobile app lineup. The technologizer and former Photoshop Touch user Harry McCracken joins us to talk all about this. Welcome to you, Harry.
Hey, Mike. It's great to be with you.
Glad you're here. Now, for those unfamiliar, can you explain what Photoshop Touch is or was?
Sure. Photoshop Touch has been around for about 4 years, and it's a version of Photoshop for iPhones and iPads and Android devices, which, you know, attempts to be pretty comprehensive. It doesn't have as many features as Photoshop does on the desktop, but it does retouching and editing and all kinds of stuff.
Really, it's a great product, right? I mean, you've been a user, and of course, I think a lot of people have been very enthusiastic about using this product. Why the heck are they killing it?
Well, it's been my go-to photo editor for a long time on my iPad. But there's a general trend in the industry towards unbundling. It's not as popular to try to build kitchen sink apps that do everything. And a lot of companies, not just Adobe, are trying to build ones that do one or two things really well. So more recently, they've rolled out programs for mobile devices like Photoshop Mix, which only does compositing and does it nicely. Photoshop Sketch, which is just about drawing. They're previewing one, which only does retouching. And instead of trying to do one comprehensive version of Photoshop for mobile devices, they think the better strategy is to do a bunch of Photoshops and then tie them together with their Creative Cloud internet-based service, so you can still work on the same file in all these different apps, but it's not one comprehensive program. It's a lot of little specialty ones.
It's interesting, and I would blame Facebook for this. They were one of the biggest companies to embrace this model where they had a service, a site, Facebook.com, that where you could do everything, the messaging, all the rest, and they've been both acquiring separate apps and also spinning things out like Messenger into separate apps, right, so that they have multiple apps. And it's clearly a good strategy, especially for a company like Facebook that has advertising. In terms of Adobe, ultimately they're selling software. Are these alternative apps, are they free? What is the monetization model for these?
That's another change. Originally, Adobe was selling Photoshop Touch for $10. So it was a pretty traditional software model. And the new apps are free. And the basic idea is that they get you into the Adobe ecosystem, and a certain percentage of the people who try them and like them will go on to pay for Creative Cloud, which is definitely a fee-based service if you want everything and if you want to be able to use it in conjunction with Photoshop and Lightroom and other desktop apps.
Now, I think all of these are iOS apps, aren't they? Are they going to offer versions for Android users?
Right. They've launched all of these on iOS so far, but they have Android versions in the works.
All right, wonderful. Well, Harry McCracken, thank you so much for explaining all that to us. Harry McCracken is at fastcompany.com, technologizer.com, and on Twitter at Harry McCracken. Thanks again, Harry.
Thanks, Mike.
Racist listings have emerged in Google Maps this week. Now, Google is scrambling to fix the problem and prevent such listings in the future. Danny Sullivan is the editor-in-chief of Search Engine Land and joins us to talk about this. Welcome to you, Danny. Thanks for being on. Now, can you talk briefly about what the problem is here? I mean, how are these listings getting into maps?
About a year ago, Google rolled out something that was called the Pigeon Update. And the idea behind this was that, you know, business owners will go through in Google Maps and describe what their businesses are about. And it's kind of like the way Yahoo used to work. You know, you have a short amount of words that are all describing. So if you were a sporting goods shop and you said you sell baseball equipment or football equipment or hockey equipment, then it understands that. If you also sold skiing equipment and you didn't say that, then maybe you're not going to show up for that sort of stuff. So with the Pigeon Update, what they tried to do is look at what people were saying about businesses across the entire web, so that if someone wrote a blog post and said, I went to this sporting goods shop, and they said the name of the shop, and they have a great selection of skiing equipment, then when someone would search for skiing equipment, maybe that business would come up. And it seems like you didn't even have to have a link to the shop. Just making a mention of the business name would be enough for Google to kind of understand that it is an entity and that it has certain things about it, and associate all that with its business listing that it uses for Google Maps. So those were the good intentions. And then what turned out to be the case is that if you've said some negative things about businesses and places and schools and universities, that these things could be associated with your business listing on Google Maps as well. And so when people were searching in the Washington, D.C. area in particular, they were searching for all sorts of racial slurs and such like that. And it was not difficult to make the White House come up for virtually anything you wanted to try. Or you would come up with, say, Howard University for slurs against blacks, or you could actually just type in words like bowl and you could get the White House as well. If you weren't in DC or you weren't centered on DC, sometimes that would still work. Or sometimes you just might find, like I did, you get like a little local record store. So it wasn't a case that somebody seemed to have actually tried to hack and attack these institutions directly as sort of a big campaign, but rather it's almost sort of a happenstance of, unfortunately, people saying terrible things on the web and that all being consolidated into the Google Maps listings.
Yeah, and Howard University, of course, a predominantly black college. Now, I thought that, you know, I thought the White House was Edward's Snowden. That's another variant of this ongoing problem. Now, what is Google doing about this?
Well, we've had three different things actually happen, and they're all unrelated. So about 2 months ago, we had someone who went to demonstrate problems with Google's business verification system and managed to create a listing in Seattle and then move it into the White House, even though it was a verified listing, and called it Edward Snowden. And that problem, as far as I know, Google still hasn't fixed. There's still a hack that you could create a listing, get it verified, and move it wherever you want. Then the other thing that happened was something people may remember, there was an area on Google Maps you could see an Android that was peeing on an Apple logo, yeah, and a few other things like that. That was caused by Google's MapMaker service, which was where people could deliberately go in and make edits to roads and excuse me, features in Google. And to stop that from happening, Google's disabled the Map Maker feature and hasn't brought it back. This third thing, as I said, wasn't directly caused by a hacking attempt. It's just sort of the happenstance of what unfortunately goes out on the web in general. And so to deal with that, Google is making use of what they call their Google Bomb algorithm. And you might recall a few years ago, you could search for miserable failure and get the George W. Bush official webpage.
Yeah.
And that's because a lot of people linked to that web page and put in the links the words miserable failure. And they did this to other people as well. And it was part of an active campaign where people thought it would be funny or, you know, campaign type orientation to make these things rank well for certain words. And so Google put in this fix, and these were called Google bombs. And in Google's fix, basically what they said was, if people link to a page with certain words in the links, but the page itself doesn't have those words or doesn't seem relevant for them, then we're no longer going to rank it for that sort of stuff. And so the same sort of thing is going to happen with maps. People might say negative things about places, but if the places themselves aren't using these kinds of slurs or derogatory words and so on, then they should no longer rank for those kinds of words in Google Maps once this fix gets fully put into place.
Now, is this is all of this a slam against open systems like opening up things like Google Maps? Should it be locked down? Should it have a more Apple approach, or do you think this can be all worked out?
It's sort of in between. It is crowdsourcing, but it's not crowdsourcing in the sense that you've kind of let anybody come in and make edits, as in MapMaker. It's really more akin to what Google has typically done looking when you search on the web. When you search on the web and you get pages that rank for anything, that's part of Google going out and crawling the entire web and basically crowdsourcing all of our knowledge. So, and that's generally been okay. They've just had more protections in place because that system, I think, is more mature. I think when they rolled out this new system to try to make maps kind of as robust in descriptions as they did with the wider web, they didn't have all the protections that needed to be in place. They haven't grown up that system as well. So, you know, this is an unfortunate learning lesson for them, but it'll probably mean that we will still get better ability to search for what we're looking for and find it on maps without these embarrassing things coming along.
And that takes place via crowdsourcing as well. So it's one crowd versus another. Danny Sullivan is at searchengineland.com, and he's at on Twitter at Danny Sullivan. Thanks for joining us today, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, the Russian government is threatening Silicon Valley giants Google, Twitter, and Facebook that they could get banned in Russia if they don't help the Kremlin censor the web and crack down on dissident bloggers. Corey Bennett writes for The Hill and joins us now. Welcome to you, Corey.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Now, how credible are these threats? Are they really going to ban Google, Twitter, and Facebook?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? We've seen in countries like China that they will actually ban. Facebook is not allowed in China. Google has pulled out of China before. So these clashes with government are not necessarily idle threats, although in Russia, we're not really sure how they're going to deal with these big tech companies. But it is a tough road for them to bear right now. Russia's been passing a lot of these laws that require companies in their own country, companies within operating within Russia's borders, to share information on bloggers, to help them censor certain web pages. And to this point, Google, Facebook, Twitter, the ones that received letters from the Kremlin on Thursday, have not complied, according to their transparency reports, have not complied with requests for data. But what they might do moving forward remains to be seen, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I believe, at least on mobile, the number one search engine in Russia is Yandex, which is a Russian search engine. Are they required to stick to this? I mean, is Yandex, for example, already handing over information about dissidents and helping the government censor the internet?
I mean, I couldn't tell you specifically about that company, but yes, everyone that's operating within Russia is complying with these laws or facing sanctions from the government.
You and your publication specialize mostly in the U.S. government. Do you think that the U.S. government is going to step in and intervene in some diplomatic way here, or are these companies on their own?
It's an interesting question because we have seen the U.S. government intervene over in China, which recently or is currently, trying to pass a slate of counterterrorism laws, national security laws, banking technology laws that really, well, if you believe the U.S. government, the European government and the international business community, would lock out a lot of foreign businesses from even operating there. They would have to use Beijing-approved encryption methods, for example, and turn over their source code to Beijing officials. So they're saying that just will not allow them to operate in the country at all. And they did actually get the Obama administration to step in. The Commerce Secretary went over to Beijing. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew went over to Beijing and had these one-on-one meetings. President Obama even called President Xi directly to discuss them. So that was kind of breaking. That was an unprecedented experience, I would say, for the U.S. government to really step in on behalf of private industry in this type of situation. Now, the situation with Russia is a bit different than in China. Tensions are much more strained between the U.S. and Russia than they are between U.S. and China. And we have not seen as much diplomatic cybersecurity relations with Russia as we have with China. Even though it's very frosty with China, they are still meeting with officials. They are still talking about having a dialogue. We don't see as much of that with Russia. So I think it's less likely that the U.S. government would step in this situation here.
I think you're right. And probably the other reason for that as well is that the economies of China and the United States are much more intertwined and codependent than are the economies of Russia and the United States. And so there's less of an economic incentive for the Russians to cooperate, et cetera. Corey Bennett is at thehill.com and on Twitter at Corey_Bennett. Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
A new Kickstarter project wants to teach kids robotics, programming, and 3D printing, all with a self-balancing 3D printed robot called Roby. The company is called Socially Shaped, and Roby is a kit. It's based on Raspberry Pi, it supports Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, and it also has a number of sensors, all of which can be programmed by children. Let's check out their video.
We are delighted to introduce you to Roby. Roby's not just a robot, it's a robotic learning platform.
Roby is the first commercially available 3D printed personalized robot. Roby balances on two wheels, has an onboard computer, in which you can program to add new tricks. Roby was designed in an open source community in which ideas are shared by people just like you.
It can walk on two wheels or drive on four. It can even use tracks.
All right, so what we see is a four-wheel device up on two of those wheels, self-balancing like a Segway. And then there's another robot that is sort of running around with. And so what kids can do is they can program these things, have them do neat tricks. They can, you know, build macros and that sort of thing. And again, this is a Kickstarter project, and you can find it on Kickstarter by looking for Roby if you want to invest in this, what looks like a very worthy project. They have got 28 days to go, so we'll see if they reach their goal. All right, if you've got the Google Tone plugin for Chrome, here's the link. Well, in follow-up news, we told you April 14th about Google's Project Fi, which is an MVNO service with a simplified data plan. I got an email invitation for Project Fi yesterday, but it turns out that the invitations won't be all sent until midsummer. They're essentially sending a small percentage of the invites each week. So by the midsummer, whenever that is, these should all be out there, all the invitations. Everybody who requested an invitation should get one. Well, in product update news, Facebook introduced the messaging app version of Caller ID to its Messenger app. It works whether the person contacting you is a Facebook friend or not. The feature is now rolling out to the app on both iOS and Android, but only in the US, the UK, India, and France. In the research and development department, researchers at the University of Turin in Italy and Yahoo Labs in Barcelona have created an algorithm that recognizes beauty in photographs. They're able to crawl Flickr and find amazing pictures that nobody has really noticed. First, they get a bunch of people to rate pictures on a scale of 1 to 5 for specific categories like children photography or furry puppies or whatever it is. And then the researchers use this information to train a machine vision system they call Crowd Beauty. Once trained, they turn it loose on Flickr and find all the pretty pictures. Very amazing technology. We've got some big numbers for you today. 45. That's the percentage of Apple Watch-owning Twitter users who tweet negative things about their Apple Watch experience, according to a new study from Crowdflower. All right, another big number, 64. That's the percentage of women who tweeted positive things about the Apple Watch. So it appears that women like the Apple Watch more than men do, according to this study. Well, finally, in news you can lose, a 3-year-old Google patent has surfaced for a teddy bear that controls home automation. You talk to it, and the bear sends commands to your home automation products. The patent specifically is for disturbing technology that enables the teddy bear to turn its head and make eye contact with whoever's talking to it. Even more unsettling is that the patent was filed in 2012, the same year that the Seth MacFarlane movie Ted came out. Coincidence? I think not.
I'm taking Lori to dinner. You don't think she's going to be expecting something big, do you?
It's been 4 years, Johnny. You and me have been together for 27 years. Where's my ring? Huh? Where's my ring?
What did all my fuzzy fingers do?
Anyway, this seems funny, but Google's patent seems creepy. You know, kind of like Chucky with, you know, teddy bear form. There's also a furry rabbit version. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Tony Hannadies, who posted this picture on Twitter. Note that Tony is the mobile tech editor for the Lazy Guys Tech podcast and has appeared on Twits All About Android in the past. We've got there's me and Christina Warren. Very nice. And we've also got an honorable mention today for Fluffy Goldfish Labs, which posted this picture of that company's CEO supposedly listening to TNT while fishing for piranhas in the Amazon jungle. Well, that's a nice try. I don't buy it. That looks like a okay Photoshop job. Of course, this company, Fluffy Goldfish Labs, is famous for their publicity stunts. And so, anyway, like I said, nice try. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. And you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Deezer, or you can choose another way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv. And if you're coming to San Francisco for Google I.O. next week, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Just send email to tickets@twit.tv. And if you'd like to help us grow that audience, here's how you can do it. Just post a link to twit.tv/TNT on the social media site of your choice, tag 3 friends, and recommend that they subscribe. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me on Flickr at flickr.com/photos/Mike Elgin. Also, don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every single weeknight. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. This show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Brian Burnett. My name is Mike Elgin. Thank you for tuning in. We're off Monday for the Memorial Day holiday here in the U.S., so we'll see you Tuesday.